the most important for us was asking a question: what are we trying to solve? Are we solving that one founder has to go there and its CEO has to be done, or there has to be VP sales to hire and he has to be from that background? What is that problem you want to solve? So today, if I have to distribute from 95% inbound and 5% all miscellaneous, today inbound is only contributing around 20%, 25%. My expansions are contributing 35, 40%. My channels are contributing close to 20%. My outbound is contributing another 20, 25%.
If you can narrow down a segment, it becomes a lot more easier. Because for your product, there can be a variety of buyers. Let's say maybe different industries can buy you, and in a different industries, different use cases you may solve. It is good to narrow down one particular segment because your narrative will become better. Your buyer persona will become better. Competition will get better. Everything will get better.
Are we moving into a stage where software has to adopt as for the user? Can technology be more savvy of user rather than user being savvy of the technology?
I think more than TAM, what excited me on, if I remember well, was a variety of use cases. Because among the first 10 customers we have, every customer is using Workfix for a different use case.
Today, if you look, there are $780 billion worth of enterprise software sold every year. That means large enterprises have more than 1,000 softwares today. How do we provide visibility to an organization in terms of what's the ROI on those software? How can we improvise on those ROIs and make employees more productive? Like if I have a XYZ or let's say Vara is there, if I say Vara, I'm going to get somebody next to you and it's just going to be Vara plus, there's no motivation. Yeah. But it has to be Vara plus, plus, plus.
So that helped both ways. It helped customers to be successful. It helped executives to be more close to the ground.
Hi, this is Siddharth Ahluwalia, co-founder of 100X Entrepreneur Podcast, along with my partner Nancy, and founder of 100X Entrepreneur SaaS Fund, where we invest only in early stage SaaS companies. I have today two icons from India SaaS ecosystem, Khadim and Vara, founders of Whatfix. Welcome, Khadim and Vara, to the 100X Entrepreneur Podcast.
Thank you, for inviting us. It's a really pleasure to be here.
So something unique about the Whatfix journey, which I want to tell about our audience, is you guys started in 2010, pivoted to enterprise software in 2013-14 timeframe, when enterprise software was not at all a category in India, right? So there was the first two category creations that you did, right? Because the traditional Indian SaaS has been focused on from India, sell through marketing, create top of the funnel, like Zoho and Freshworks are doing, right? And they're very marketing heavy companies. And what happens is when you have such large examples, other people try to follow the suit. So that was the first category creation I would, you know, say that you did, right? Building for enterprise from India in 2013-14. And the second is people want to follow something which has been done, right? So digital adoption was zero category. And why people want to follow is there's already a budget in enterprises, especially, you know. So you trying to create a budget. So kudos to you, you know, for successfully completing like 10 years of Whatfix and creating two categories from India. Now everybody talks about those, right? Go to US, create a new category.
It's become a playbook.
You have created a playbook. But let's dive deep into it, right? When you were thinking, like, so your first journey was, right, you were trying for the first 3 years, you were trying to sell to SMBs a software that they could manage their social media.
Yeah.
And when you tried to help them because they were not using the software, how to use it better, you created Fixit. And once customers started asking from you, hey, can we use it to fix it for ourselves? Then you build Whatfix. And Whatfix was still SMB focused at that point.
It's actually started from a community. From community, we went to SMB. And from SMB, we came to enterprise. And that's where we got real fit, actually.
Yeah, by community, it was like a YouTube. We created a platform where anyone can come in and create a guide on anything.
Yeah.
It could be, how do I book a ticket, to how do I file my tax returns, to anything. So from there, there's a lot of journey to get to the enterprise.
And the other unique thing is, Vara, you are the CTO of the company. You moved to US and Khadim stayed in India. Why did that, right? In most of the SaaS companies, the CEO moves and the entire tech teams, including the CTO, sits in India.
By the time we decided somebody has to move, I think we were already a couple of million dollars in ARR and 3 to 4 years in the journey. Yeah. And some of the advice when I spoke to other founders who were a few steps ahead of us was, don't break things which are working. And we were able to do a lot of GTM from India for US market. Now, as you mentioned, it's a new category. There's no budget item defined. We knew that we have to put a lot more work in figuring out what's the best solution or right solution which will eventually win this category. So somebody has to work very closely with the customers, identify how they're using Whatfix, what are the other adjacencies, and how this category will evolve. And I was looking a lot more at GTM, which was working fine. So we continued to do heavy lifting from here. If I would have moved, the gravity would have shifted. So best person was Vara, who would actually go to US, work with the customers and evolve the category. That in hindsight actually has worked out well. And the results are there, like maybe anything different?
Yeah, no, that was exactly the reason. So I moved in around 2018. So by then, we didn't have any pre-sales person or anyone who's a little bit more technologist in the sales cycle. So my intent at that time was that I move to the US and I go and visit the customers and explain them the product. So that was the rationale that I moved. Then just before I moved, we hired Vispy there. Vispy was acting as our salesperson on the ground in North America. Though, I mean, we have a lot of sellers here. All of them were selling to the US market. But in some of the deals, we needed to go and meet customers. We wanted to go and meet at that time because we could learn a lot more. So I was the one who was filling that gap. So I was going and meeting customers. And the other part which helped a lot, which obviously a founder moving there helps a lot in hiring, because people would join because it's an unknown company and hardly no one existed in the US. People were just joining because a founder is talking to them and the founder is giving them confidence and he's talking about the vision.
So mostly one was about that implementation would become more strong, right, if Vara moves to US. And the second is a co-founder leading it. So I have seen 90% of the cases, the first VP sales from India goes terribly wrong, and then the founders become cold feet that they say this is not working, then I have to move it. But in your case, the CTO moved. And the second best thing, you know, that you did is Vispy came in,
yeah,
right? And Vispy first came in as an angel in 2014. And how did you convince Vispy to join you full time?
It's a long story. So we met Vispy first in one of the workshops which was arranged by GSF. We were as part of the cohort in Valley.
Yeah.
And actually, in fact, that was the first time we both visited the US actually.
Yeah.
And understood the local market. First thing we got to know is like selling for $100 is no point. But anyway, so after meeting Vispy in the workshop, we realized that he has a very strong understanding in the customer support domain, because he was part of the board of another company which was acquired by Parachure, being from his previous, he was a partner in the venture world, right? So after the workshop, when we pitched, he really resonated with the concept, immediately committed our angel round, introduced a few more angels. And that's how, and we also gave him a board seat because we really liked what he brought to the table. I remember like in the second year of our WattFix journey, we were supposed to attend an event in US, Dreamforce. We were 5-6 people company. We didn't even have enough people with the visa to fill the booth of four people actually. So 3 of us flew from India and we asked Vispy to double down. Like, can he be part of them? He said, fine. 3 days, the way he hustled on the floor, it gave him the confidence about the category and how it resonates in the market. Plus, like what we saw, how he was hands-on and talking to the potential people, because even he didn't have much of sales experience before. Actually, that brought us very close in terms of understanding and belief in the category and all. After that, we got him on board for a day or two as a consultant and advisor so that he can double up as a face to potential customers. And when he was trying his other initiative, which we didn't take off, I asked Vispy that, would you like to join WattFix? His first comment was, what will be the upside? I don't see this probably getting to 100 mil exit, because we were at a very small number. I said, yeah, I can also see 100 mil. The way we figured out to 100 mil, maybe together we'll figure out to maybe half a bill and billion. He thought for a while, for a few days, and then he said, okay, let's do it. So he came on board. We asked him to take over sales. We already had a few sales guys. And now he's like one of the very core members, like a founder.
Yeah. Actually, when he joined in, it wasn't like we asked him to head the sales. It's the first time that he was doing sales. He never did it before. I mean, he was from the corp dev background and investment. Prior to investment, he was in corp dev background. But he has a lot of hustle. He wants to figure it out. He was a hands-on seller and I was his partner, sales engineer. Both of us were going and visiting.
So I think you being there in the US, right? You were also there at that point in time. And you tag team with Vispy.
Yes.
So that helped, because if you have left him alone in US
it would have been very hard, very hard. Even I own the product, I know everything about the product. So we would tag team, we would go together to all the prospects and we talk. So eventually he got better he became a good seller and then he started showing a lot of good managerial leadership attributes. And then he started slowly managing.
So one thing to add actually, maybe from the Vispy's experience and Vara moving to US, I think one underlying theme is actually we avoided following a pattern which was there in the market or whatever. Of course, that was one of the data points to learn. But the most important for us was asking a question, what are we trying to solve? Are we solving that one founder has to go there and its CEO has to be done? Or there has to be VP sales to hire and he has to be from that background? What is that problem we want to solve? And every time when we answered that, okay, this is what we are trying to solve, the result came up very sometimes radical, sometimes regular playbook, or sometimes some decision which actually really became productive over a period of time. Whether it's Vara's movement, getting Wispy on board, doing several other hirings.
You were first-time founders, right? And you pivoted. So I would always call it first-time because you pivoted from the previous product to the current product. And I believe the company structure would have also remained the same.
It's the same company.
The same company. So it would have made more sense for you to follow any other playbook rather than creating your own, because every time you create your own playbook, there are questions from stakeholders and self-doubt as founder that why are we doing it? So how did you avoid falling into the trap of going for an existing
some bias? It would definitely happen, right? As I was mentioning, first answer the question, like, what are we trying to solve here? Once you have that, talk to a few founders, like, how did they solve this problem? There's always 2-3 people who have a couple of few steps ahead of you. While trying to solve that problem, what kind of challenges they faced? So from many founders, we heard like they tried to solve in an ABC way, like hiring people in US or getting some specific leadership, how it worked, how it didn't work, what are the pitfalls. So learn from those and try to actually apply to your dynamics, because every company has its own challenges or variables, right? See what is the best for you and take that call, because end of the day, you are answerable as a founder. People will give suggestions, but you need to make a call because you're on the ground. I think that's what has worked, and reduce the bias as much as possible.
In my view, every company is different. Every product is different. Even if you are building the same product, two different company, two different founders, it will be very differently operated. It will be very differently executed. So I think it's good to learn what others have done, but I don't think it's necessary for us to follow. As long as what Kadim told, that we knew what we are doing, what's the objective.
I'll give an example, actually. Like, everybody says, like, enterprise would not work from India, specifically GTM. Yeah. It has to be local, because that's what everybody told us. Mm-hmm. Okay, from India, you can build SMBs, but enterprise, you need to be locally present. Oh, why is that, right? Like, take an example. You are head of sales for Coca-Cola, for example, and you are doing a digital transformation or changing your CRM stack from, let's say, Siebel to Salesforce. You're not going to Google, like, what stack should I use? You're going to call up your procurement head and say, okay, let's roll out an RFP of $25 million. I'm going to revamp my CRM stack.
Yeah.
I want to get to the next generation. Even your procurement head is not going to do that.
Yeah.
He's going to give an RFP to Deloitte or Accenture, Infosys of the world. They're going to pitch, I have a Dynamics practice, I have a Salesforce practice, and this are the other CLM, CPQ tool, and this is going to be my stack, right? There's no Googling happening here. So in a well-defined category, there are 2 or 3 players who are occupying the mindshare. Even if you go to Gartner's and Forrester, they're going to tell you the 3 players.
Yeah.
Even if you look at the Magic Quadrant, and everybody wants to work with them. Now imagine that digital transformation has happened. People are not using it. Now that's head of Coca-Cola sales says to his head of learning, say, I've spent $25 million, but I'm not getting benefit out of it.
Yeah.
I've done classroom, the CLO would say, I've done classroom trainings, I've done documentation, I've done all the handholding possible, still not working. Figure out why not. Talk to Gartner's. Check in the event, check to the peers, ask an analyst to Google and say how people do change management today when they do the CRM stack.
Yeah.
Now that's the change, right? Which has happened because of inflection, because from on-premise to cloud movement, from off context to in context or on-demand movement, right? It's a new category, has a potential of landing in, even into large enterprise. In this case, even inbound might work. There's a potential wherever you're sitting globally, because you're solving a problem which is actually people are trying to solve with the legacy methods. And there's a potential of a new entrant here. And there's no clear mind share. So for next 7-8 years, when the category gets established, there's a potential of 2 or 3 players to get there. Get into Gartner's, get into Forrester's, get into the mindshare of enterprise executives, maybe make your inbound work, make your events work. And then the category establishes and it repeats the cycle. So need to understand from the first principle exactly who is your buyer. How are they going to think about solving that particular problem? And what are they going to use as a mechanism? You might completely evolve your GTM differently. The existing methodologies people are propagating, you have to be here, you have to be here, this is the way enterprise work, may not apply.
But in your case, then how did you manage to get in front of, let's say, the top 10 enterprise first clients that you got?
I remember like first few clients, we started from India. We got Flipkart, we got ICICI Bank. They were the first two enterprise customers. We got one in Germany, one library, and then one we got in Boston. So some of them were a lot more hustle from our side, promising them that, okay, we are a very small, nimble company. We can adapt your features, move very fast with you. This is our roadmap, making them believe that we are a partner in innovation for long term. Somehow get that entry, even if it's very small. But make sure that you can use that story and a logo as much as possible. And when you have this first four or five use cases, first of four or five case studies, logos, testimonial, the sixth, seventh, eighth customer starts becoming easier and easier to get. Like today we have 71 of Fortune 500. Whenever we open that logo slide, nobody asks the questions, where are you based? Right? Because there's already trust established, right? You're already authoritative in that particular domain. But first 3 to 4, you need to really hustle and get somehow those logos, irrespective of price point, irrespective of how much you need to maneuver.
No, I think more tactically to answer that question, so initial days, the events helped us a lot, like the Dreamforce that we attended. It changed all our view because every person who is coming to the booth when we speak with, everyone is relating to the problem statement, everyone. So we could clearly understand the problem is really big in the enterprise with employees and adoption. So the events gave us a lot of leads. And then obviously everything around online. So whether it is ads or content, all of those also gave a lot of opportunities in the early days.
And one other counterintuitive thing that you did is Dreamforce was which year that you attended?
This was 2016.
2016. You were barely like below half a million ARR.
Yes. Correct? Yes.
And you put up a booth there.
We put a booth, yeah.
How much did it cost?
It was actually at that point, along with the booth and everything, it costed $35,000-$40,000.
Yes. And how much you had in bank?
700K, 600K something. Wow. So it was a bet.
It was a big investment, actually. It got a lot.
You had to believe intuitively that it was a riskier.
But that's again the counterintuitive, because you are selling something digital, right? Software is completely digital experience. And why is that? Is physical presence is required to sell the software, right? It should be sold digitally.
Yeah. So we were already selling digitally, actually, right? But then we wanted to validate much faster and quicker into specific segment, because we were trying to create a motion on top of CRM.
Yeah.
Because that's a low-hanging fruit for us.
Yes.
And Dreamforce is one place where like 100,000 plus footfalls.
There's the CRM
mecha. Ecosystem, yeah. Right? So within that first like 3 days, 3.5 days, it was an event. We would have spoken to 300 people. And the pitch which we had on day one for the first potential was somebody who visited our booth to the last pitch was dramatically different.
Yeah.
In fact, I'll tell you one story. Prior to Dreamforce, we were selling for around $2,000-$3,000 a year, right? A year, not a month. Now, when we went to Dreamforce, we thought, okay, we'll sell expensive. Now, what is expensive? We said, okay, we'll sell it for $8,000-$10,000. One of our potential customer visited our booth and he asked for the concept, really loved it. And he asked for the price point. So Prakhar, who is our head of territory sales, he was a sales rep then. He told $8,000. Our intent was $8,000 a year. The person quickly said, okay, 8 into 12, $96,000. That looks fine. That was a shock for us, right? Like we were selling for 8 and the guy saying 96,000 is fine. Because the person is spending $20 million on a sales force, a few hundred thousand dollars actually, it's fine for ensuring there's a ROI on top of that platform. So such kind of learnings were very difficult to get it remotely. And the iteration in terms of pitch, the use cases, resonating with the persona, quickly getting that go-to-market fit is very, very well in person. Even in India, when we started, as soon as we used to get a demo request, because first 8-9 customers, were in India, we used to go and meet as much as possible in person. We can see the reaction. I'll tell you, I'm going to charge you $2,000. See the reaction. Maybe $8,000. Yeah. So you can iterate very quickly. That's what it mattered a lot.
Yeah. Also, eventually what we learned also that it is just not the price point, but the effort that it takes to onboard an enterprise is very, very different, because enterprise operates at its own complexity and the expectations are very different from a small business, where small business expect a lot more self-serve, a very standardized experience, but enterprise has a very different experience. So that's all a lot of learning that we had over a period of time.
Even the addressable market size, right? Prior to Dreamforce, I was thinking SaaS companies and some enterprise companies in few softwares they're going to use, maybe some specific type of companies. We didn't know that detail of how CRM is deep. Another example was one person met us at a booth saying, okay, I want to use, this looks very relevant. I have 300 or 400 sales guys. The price point looks, we asked what they do. They do glass cleaning, right? And those companies are ready to pay $50,000, $100,000 for a Wotfix on top of Salesforce. That immediately gives the perspective of how big the potential is, how big the TAM is. So remotely, you have a fixed thing. Okay, I know this is my persona I'm going to go behind. Here, suddenly you will see, you'll start discovering things which you don't know. You don't know. So a lot more discovery happens there.
And then after that Dreamforce, right? Events became your primary go-to-market playbook.
Yeah, it was one of the go-to-market channels for sure.
Can you detail the journey after it?
Yeah. So I think when we started, actually, we started initial validation with Outbound. So he used to give me 25 email IDs a day, and I used to send those email IDs, get that couple of demos, and then try to close. So first 8 to 10 customers came by Outbound. Then we onboarded, like, first hiring was sales guy, second hiring was marketing, third hiring was marketing, and fourth was engineer, right? Because he always told me that as long as we know the requirements, we can fix it. Actually, we need somebody to sell and help us there. So once I got Vipul and a couple of other guys on marketing on board, idea was, how can I build my inbound engine? Because Outbound, we knew it's hard to scale in early on. It was okay for validation. And we started doing inbound. I think for first couple of million dollars, 95% of our revenue came from inbound after initial validation of outbound. Post that, we started doing events along with parallelly. Events took a while. Initially, events were only for validation and refining the pitch and all. Converting was not that easy. It was more of creating the market awareness and all. Gradually, we also learned how to actually utilize events for converting, like getting the potential customers, existing customers, asking them to talk, and customers who are already evaluating in the cycle and they are on the fence, get them to the event so that they build the trust and all. So events started becoming gradually the second channel, which started contributing. Then we started, some inbound started coming on channels, like system integrators, which deploy CRM or HR, like those started getting into. After that, we started reviving our outbound. So having SDR, BDRs, doing cold calling, generating opportunities. And then finally, our content started kicking off, and content is also now started contributing. And as we started creating a base of enterprise, expansion became a huge thing. So today, if I have to distribute from 95% inbound and 5% all miscellaneous, today inbound is only contributing around 20%, 25%. My expansions are contributing 35, 40%. My channels are contributing close to 20%. My outbound is contributing another 20, 25%. So it's widespread today.
But every channel, we did a lot of experimentation, right? From outbound, so many different variants we tried. Go ahead.
So I was asking, right? The Dreamforce event, right? You took your learnings from that. Right, you got in front of 300 customers on a daily basis.
Yeah.
And after, I think, 1,000 interactions, your mind would have blown, right? That such a large market is present out there. I think back then, the Stellaris round wasn't there, right? It was just
Stellaris was not there. Yeah, Stellaris were not there. That's right.
It was only $1 million from Helion. Yeah. That set, right? And you, as you mentioned, 700K, 800K was remaining in the bank. Yeah. So those 1,000 customers that you got in front of, what were your next set of events that you did in the US market?
Yeah, actually, post that, there was a pause. We didn't do events for a bit. Because just immediately coming out of the event, all our perception at that time was that we spoke with so many people and so much of interest, we thought we could close a lot of deals. But gradually, we realized over the days that we couldn't really close much because company wasn't ready, product wasn't ready. Yeah. So there's a lot of enterprise expectations which we were not ready at that time. So we didn't do, I don't believe we did too many events after that. There was a pause until the product
two or three
got
a year.
Ready. Yes. After that, maybe we scaled up again the events.
And then when did you start like event as a proper playbook, like doing at least 4 to 5 events in a year?
Once we realized that, how do we convert the customers from events? Because see, if events, if 1,000 people are meeting us, those people are also meeting another 20 companies. Yeah. Sometimes after 3 days, they don't even remember however good you are. So we started learning that somebody comes to the booth, take a photograph, and, like a lot of hacks around that. Plus have a dedicated SDR team for only events, right? So, and then 2 or 3 dedicated people for event management and field marketing and all. So as those structures started getting more clean and clear, events started becoming a playbook, right? Event, actually, we got the real benefit is when we have, let's say, another 100 opportunities in conversations.
Yeah.
Can I get 20 of those to meet in the booth? Because most of these guys are talking online in Zoom, right? Can I get this 20? Out of my 100 customers, can I get my 15 customers on the booth and just try to make a match there so that if somebody hears from existing customers, half of the deal is sold there actually, right? So when we started doing those, the real ROI started happening. A lot of customers were the 50%, 70% there. They started converting 1 week, 2 weeks after the event. They go back and sign the contract, right? So that's how our playbook started evolving. Dedicated SDR team, dedicated field marketing team, getting all those customers and all. Today, we have around 7 to 8 people dedicated on events. We do close to 100 events offline and online in a year, right? And it's already contributing 25% kind of, 20-25% kind of a revenue. And the deals what we make from events are pretty big, right? And now we are also narrowing down, going to creating our own roundtables, calling only CIOs and CLOs in different cities. There are too many different variations in event. Not only that booth, like Dreamforce, our own event scale, where we have like 1,000 people joining, and then roundtables, then we do our own podcasts and webinars. There's so many variations now.
So if you have to go one step back, right? And let's say, would you do a like a 10 to 15 member roundtable just post the Dreamforce to your most interested prospects?
What happens is, like, specifically in our category, when it's not a clearly budget line item defined, you always don't start from CIO. You start with the business functions. So you end up talking to head of operations or head of sales or someone, and they would try to buy WhatFix for their particular department.
Yeah.
So in those cases, these events like Dreamforce and other events works really well. Now, I already have a couple of business functions using. Then it's really good to call for a roundtable with the CIOs and say, there are already some footprints. Why not maybe make it enterprise-wide and spread across organization and really get a larger deal? I think that kind of playbook is working out well for us. Get those events a little bit more spray, get an entry, work on that account, get a CIO with a solid story of that particular enterprise and account, and try to go big in that. So that's working out fine now. Directly meeting for the CIO first time in a Dreamforce, even if they come to roundtable, may or may not work. It might be hard to pull it off.
But I think it will also evolve because the category is still new. It is not that every CIO is already putting a budget at.
Yeah.
So, but category is evolving there. But as the category evolves there, we'll be able to do top-down fully.
Hi, everyone. Before we begin, I would like to share that this podcast is brought to you by Prime Venture Partners, an early stage VC fund led by Amit Somani, Shripati Acharya, and Sanjay Soni. Prime is often the first institutional investor in category-defining tech startups in fintech, SaaS, healthcare, and education, such as MyGate, Quizzes, Planet Spark, Bolt, and Clip. To know more about Prime, visit primevp.in.
And I think another thing that you did it, that you, rather than giving customer success the entire responsibility, right, of farming the account. So there are two motions, right? Hunting is getting new accounts. Yes. And farming is going one level below and keep on nurturing the existing account. You keep on increasing their annual contract value.
Yeah.
So you put a lot of focus on farming, right, from early on. And rather than outsourcing it to customer success, you build the motion of account managers. Share more about that.
Yeah, so that also evolves, right? Like, it was not like a day one, okay, we'll have this structure, right? Because when we talk to most of the other companies, they have sales guys doing both.
Yeah.
Or success guys doing both, right? There's no dedicated farming team. We initially thought like success guys would do it. There was partial results there. And we realized that there's always too much of glory when somebody gets new dollars and it gets published, right? So everybody gets a lot of pat on the back. And the focus goes away from the value realization. Again, I'll go to the first principle approach. We were talking about the Coca-Cola example, right? So somebody buys Salesforce today, they will know what to expect out of Salesforce. I will need an SI to implement. I will have a Salesforce administrator. I would have a sales operations person. But somebody buys WhatFix, they don't know how to realize ROI out of that. So who onus is on the vendor or the software seller to do heavy lifting? Now, if my success guys actually do focus on expansions, who would do heavy lifting of realizing the ROI for the customers? So good, we realized this very early on, and we changed that success guys will only focus on NPS, ROI, business reviews, quarterly business reviews, and renewals. That's it. No expansions. Even if it happens, give it to sales guys. Your core KPI is this. And that miraculously worked. Today, like, kind of feedback we get from Fortune 500 customers, it's not like we are the best DAP player. You are the best ever vendor we have ever worked. Right?
Wow.
That kind of comments we get. And because that's focused and we really went deep and we created a lot of stuff there. Now, coming back, of course, we are leaving a lot of money on the table because we're not expanding there. So being a new category again, market is wide open. If I ask sales guy to expand, if expand is low hanging fruit, logo acquisition is hard, they're going to focus here.
Yeah.
So we had to specialize again. So we said, okay, this team is going to focus only on hunting. There's another team which is going to set up, is going to focus only on farming, define a clear rules of engagement, how the accounts will move in between all these three teams, including success. It took a while. It took a couple of years of iteration, but it's working phenomenally well today.
But actually, there's also a little bit of nuance to our own product, right?
Mm.
So for many products, they could only sell once in any one account.
Yeah.
So you're selling a procurement software. You can only sell once because there's only one procurement department. But for WhatFix, that's not like that. So WhatFix has applicability across every software that is deployed in the company. So we could just go sell to sales, and then we can go to HR, we can sell to procurement, we can sell to finance, we can sell to so many. So what we realized is that we needed a special focus for expansion, because the one single account, let's say a large enterprise of 10,000, 100,000 employees, that itself is a huge TAM for us. So a good seller could just have one account and make their quota year over year.
So give 6 to 7 large accounts to one account manager.
Yes.
And let that account manager only be focused on growing those accounts.
Yes. Yes. Just get their quota from that only.
Yes.
So even GTM, actually, if I have to, somebody ask, define my GTM model, right?
Yeah.
So it'll be one line. Learn from India, expand in the region. So I have 70% account managers or 80% account managers in the region, but my land team is 90% in India. And considering the land unit economics, like I land at $800,000 and then expansion can happen even at a million, that economics also works really well.
There's a handover happening, right? Your greenfield is hunting from India, right? Let's figure out 50 to 100K accounts.
Yeah.
As soon as we grow them to a certain scale, figure out who is the best account manager.
So the account managers are territory-wise, right? Yeah. So there's a account manager sitting in Boston, somebody sitting in Chicago, somebody sitting in LA. So depending on the region, maybe we're also trying to specialize in terms of industry, right? Okay, automobile or something. So it's a combination of region plus industry. That's what direction we are moving. In fact, just to add on the territory sales part or hunting part, always surprises us actually, right?
Yeah.
So early on when we used to talk about doing sales from India, many of our investors and other investors or other saying it's fine to do 5K deal from India, 10K deal from India. We were doing that. If we started doing 25K deal, maybe it's working.
Yeah.
Fine. We started doing 50K. We started doing 100K. Oh, this is something different. Today we are landing 500,000 and 1 million from India.
Yeah. Because right? There's a brand built.
Brand built, but it's possible, right?
So brand built and also categories evolved a little. Huh. So there's a little bit more awareness of the category.
What would you advise to SaaS founders, right? When to focus on brand? Because see, every SaaS founder believes that, hey, I have a product, I have a sales guy. Why is not the selling happening?
My general recommendation is that, which we have also learned during our outbound experiments on many places, is if you can narrow down a segment, it becomes a lot more easier. Because for your product, there can be a variety of buyers. Let's say maybe different industries can buy you, and in a different industries, different use cases you may solve. It is good to narrow down one particular segment because your narrative will become better. Your buyer persona will become better, competition will get better, everything will get better. So my recommendation for any startup in the early days could be, can you narrow down the segment? So the book of Crossing the Chasm explains that really, really well. So the more you can narrow the segment, your go-to-market become more efficient and easy.
I'll give you an example, actually, what he's saying. So our value prop can be like, I'll reduce your support tickets by 50%.
Yeah.
I'll improve your productivity, sales productivity. It's very horizontal, right? And if you're a head of a particular department, let's say in insurance, say fine, at the moment, if that's a burning problem, I'll say yes, otherwise I'll ignore it.
Yeah.
Now, let's say head of claims department. I go to the head of claims department for property and casualty insurance and I say, I'm going to help you reduce your claims processing time. I'm going to help you reduce your claims error and improve your claims compliance so that you don't hit by claims penalties. Now, these are the day-to-day problems they want to solve. And as soon as they say, okay, my claims processing time can come down by 20%, let me look, because it's a competitive advantage. That's my KPI or day in, day out. I'm doing $1 billion claims every month, right? They want to listen to it. So when you narrow down, your messaging actually starts resonating really well. Then when you go deeper, now this claims stack is built only on 3 or 4 applications, maybe Guidewire, maybe something here. It's easy to strike partnership because you have such a narrow story. When I go to SIs, insurance practice, it resonates very well. Now you build that ecosystem of your SI partners, your software vendors or OEM partners. You have 5-10 logos in that particular department of an insurance industry. When I go to another 5, another 10, somebody would have already heard that they are moving the jobs or they are talking into some events. You are already a mini brand. So instead of going for building a large brand, start from that mini. Like, okay, in this particular PNC industry, which is like $100 million TAM, I think everybody knows me. And then maybe use that bowling pin approach, like, okay, what's next? Can I go to life and annuities? Can I go to digital banking and start? So that's the better way of creating brand rather than saying, okay, I want to go big bang. By the time you reach 10 million, already that mini brand starts happening here and there in pockets. Just capitalize on that.
Going again back to Dreamforce, right? Because that's when I think WhatFix 2.0 was born.
Yeah.
Right. So what was the next 2-3 years?
I would say 1.0 only. Before that, it was all experiments.
What was the brand building that went into consciously into the company for the next 2-3 years after that?
So, of course, doubling down more on the events where we used to start creating awareness, creating that top of the funnel. That was one. Second, we started working with analysts. There's a new category. We started pretty early on to talk to Gartners, Forresters, IDCs, Everest, and many others to keep them briefing on what we are doing, how this category is evolving, because they also want to learn and write papers. That actually started giving us a lot of rewards in the last 18, 24 months. But it used to take 3 to 4 years early on to keep giving them. Third, channels, right? Like, we went channels pretty early when we were $2 million, $1.5 million in revenue. But it doesn't move the needle very early on because it takes a lot of effort to even get entry into the channels and show them the value. Occasional deals you will get. But by the time when the category is evolving, the CIOs start creating this as a budget item, they would talk to Accenture, they would talk to Deloitte or Infosys or Wipro or TCS, and you are already in the radar. So I would say analyst relationship, your events is one of the top of the funnel to create that marketing awareness, your channels, which also helps in branding and awareness. And then a couple of other things like writing your own white papers, put your knowledge, whatever you guys have accumulated, creating those white papers and building that thought leadership along with content, webinars, podcast. That was another thing.
I think the content we invested a lot in the last few years, the investment continuously kept on increasing because those are the things that are required for people to understand your category and get familiarized with it.
They create the narrative and try to drive that narrative actually, right? Like one narrative which we are trying to do for last year or more or so, even which is resonating with the analysts and all. Like so far, we all believe like as a user, we have to adapt to the software, right? Now, are we moving into a stage where software has to adopt as for the user? Can technology be more savvy of user rather than user being savvy of a technology? So how can we create a layer of on top of technology which actually understands the users better and make them more productive? And that's what we call userization as a philosophy. So build that narrative and actually see that narrative picks up. And you, when somebody talks about userization, somebody talks about adoption, by default, first thing comes to your mind is, okay, it's WhatFix.
And if you have to go back in your ideal customer profile again, which Vara talked about, right? That be very focused on a miniature profile. What was that one profile? Were you looking in a particular industry that, let's say, I'm targeting only BFSI in US or I'm...
So initially when we started off, we didn't. But what we did was that we targeted the use cases very clearly. Like we targeted sales and HR. These were the two strong use cases we targeted. Events and marketing, everything was revolved around that. Because these are the two functions that exist irrespective of industry, very horizontal. So that's what we targeted. When we started doing outbound, it was around 3 to 4 years back. So that's when we narrowed down to a particular industry. We narrowed down to property and casualty insurance.
Which one?
Property and casualty insurance. These are essentially automobile and home insurance companies which sell those. So we targeted those companies because we wanted to try outbound in a very segmented approach that I talked about. So we created a separate sales team, separate BDR team, separate product marketing. It's almost think of it like a mini company within WhatFix. So who started targeting only the insurance companies? The results were extremely good. So then we started going to the adjacent segments, to the life insurance, then to the financial services, the more adjacencies that we can keep growing.
So let's, go to the 1 to 10 journey, 1 to 10 million ARR journey, right? That's when you had early success, right? Early believers, building the repeatable motion now. How did you encounter the persona of the IT security, IT ops, security ops, and then finally the CFO being the hurdles in your purchase journey, because you were sitting on top of the CRM, Salesforce, right? And then these guys could come in and say, hey, is it really required? Because they might not understand the user persona.
Yeah, definitely. Initially, we didn't know what it takes to sell to their enterprise because it's just not enough for the product to be strong and having a good value prop. It is important that all the other stakeholders feel confident that the product is secure enough and safe enough. So because we sit on the core applications as you talked about, CRM or HR software, where there's a lot of employee confidential data that exists. So our early realization is that for us to be able to sell to enterprise, we need to do certain things such as basic compliances that need to be in place. So we did a lot of those. Post those, it had become a lot more easier because prior to that, it would take a lot of effort to convince the security and IT teams because if you don't have a compliance, then you'll have to be able to explain many things to them. So post those compliances, it has become better. Then eventually we formed our own information security group and we continue to do new compliances every year.
Can you share some examples like where a deal could have got stuck at the CFO or the IT ops level and
Yeah, many. Very early days, there was a very large food chain in the US. So they sent us a questionnaire of probably around 200 questions that they wanted us to answer. It was the first time we have ever seen such a questionnaire. So they asked a lot of details about where do you host? So do you have a disaster recovery center? Actually, we didn't have a lot of knowledge of many of those during those early days. Then we slowly started figuring, I mean, that deal we couldn't win because we weren't ready. So most of those 200 items, we had to say no because we weren't doing any of those. So then we started focusing, we focused a lot on compliance, and then we started taking care of a lot of those precautions. Post that it was okay.
On the CFO side, actually, because we enter one or two applications, generally the budget comes from the business function. So business function has already carved off the budget. And when it goes to CFOs or by the time the budget problem is not there, unless like today's day when we even landed a large $1 million, $500,000. So that's where the CFOs come. So now I think many of the companies, we're also seeing the sales cycles are increasing. Instead of 3 approvers, then there are 5 approvers. Yes. So those things are happening. But by the time it reaches them, the next level has figured out the budget, where it's going coming from, how much is allocated. Definitely more questions in terms of what's the ROI, value. How we're going to see the value levers. And as we also evolved as a company, right, like maybe not exactly 1 to 10, but as we are evolving, let's say from 200 mil, gradually we're getting there. There are different personas you're trying to build product, right? A product for that entry level was having a solid fit. Now, does it have for the head of IT? Does it have it for CIO? So we were solving problem for, let's say, one of the applications adoption. Now, can I solve the bigger problem of an organization? Because today, if you look, there are $780 billion worth of enterprise software sold every year. That means large enterprises have more than 1,000 softwares today. How do we provide visibility to an organization in terms of what's the ROI on those software? How can we improvise on those ROIs and make employees more productive? So if I answer that question, it not only answers CIO or CFO in a big way, because they also need to somebody solve that problem, but also it boils down to the employee level. So we had a solid product market fit at the application layer or application level or user level, but we need to build a lot more into the stack or many more products to get the product market fit at the CIO or a CFO level. But when we get there, we are talking about multi-million dollar deals, right? So some products evolve in the journey, and I think we are onto that path as well.
Because what I've historically seen is 90% of the founder underestimate what it requires to sell to an enterprise.
Yes. So the cycles actually, sometimes sales cycles kills early stage because you want to show result very quickly. Now, you start your sales cycle, you have initial demonstration, show the value levers, and then you need to register as a vendor. After registering as a vendor, then you need to go through the IT security clearance, cloud clearance. And then suddenly you get to know that, there's going to be committee which is going to discuss, or procurement is going to roll out RFP. You have finished all these tests, but doesn't mean you have won, because there's a policy that anything more than $100,000, you need to have an RFP or something. You're back to square. So the sales cycle sometimes takes 4, 6, 8 months and all. The process has to evolve. Like we call something like sequence of events, right? Like when we talk to a buyer, we ask them, this is the process we have learned from our other buyers, that post your initial evaluation of a WhatFix, somebody has to register as a vendor because we need to go through IT security. We need to go through XYZ. So who are your POCs? Can we do this parallelly? So when you start those parallelly, your sales cycle doesn't go to 8 months. You can actually start seeing get squeezed into 4 months. We ask them proactively, who is your procurement? Can you cross-check with them for our kind of a product, for our kind of a ticket size? Do you need an RFP or single vendor budget is fine? Because every company has a different process. So discovering all those steps very early on, creating that sequence of events and getting a buy-in from your champion actually makes life a lot easier. So again, when you don't know, when you're starting for the first time, you're having surprises. Everything is finished and now you're saying you're going to have a buying committee. You're going to present again there, right? Yeah. So as a founder, you will get surprises when the sales guy is saying, we're going to close this in next week. But the next week doesn't come for next 6 months. But they also don't know. Yeah. So the process also has to keep evolving. And eventually, that's what enterprise sales process is.
Yeah. And probably 10 or 20 is a stakeholder, right? The founders never expect. Hmm. They only expect their ICP to be the stakeholder.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when these people start to get into purchase decisions or implementation.
So one thing which we also tell all our salesperson actually, that this is your champion, this is your persona whom you're going to interact with. But consider this guy is going to go and sell internally to another 20 people. So not only you need to sell to this guy, but you need to enable this guy so that he can go and sell to another 20 guys inside. Because sometimes they will expose you to other buyers, or they may not, because they want to be the layer in between. So enabling this person with all, like, spoon feeding as much as possible. Okay, this is my value report. What else you would need? Okay, this is my security white paper. What else you would need? Enable them that as much as possible. So we create a micro website also for every account where all the collaterals are mentioned. So make life easy for that person. So they just open that microsite and see everything what they need so that they can demonstrate internally if they want. Ask them that, okay, do you want me to be presenting to your stakeholders or your buying committee? Let me know. So use that is your representing as inside seller. So understanding that is very, very crucial.
But the most important thing is also to talk about value. Because if not only you need to sell to this, your ICP, you also have to be able to sell with that value to across CFO, CIO, everyone. So being able to talk about value in a very clear terms that the company can understand is really, really important.
Another pitfall, what I've seen, like, early on, right? Good amount of customers would ask, I need to do pilot.
Yeah.
Right? No, you charge for pilot, you don't charge for pilot. What is the outcome of the pilot? So again, very clearly defining, let's call it pilot statement of work. Like, okay, what's the duration of going to be my pilot? Who are the people who are going to get involved? What's the mechanism to validate that his pilot is successful or not successful? What is the result outcome? Who are the testers, or is it end users? When you identify and clearly list out everything out, it's very easy to go and convince even the champion, saying, okay, all these things you can do it in 3 weeks. Why you need 3 months? If you're going to do it in 3 months, I'm going to charge you. If you're going to do 3 weeks, it's okay. So we also first understand the requirements very clearly. Yeah. Try to squeeze as much as possible as a smaller POC of 2 weeks, 3 weeks, because it's feasible, it's possible. If somebody really wants to go for longer, then ask them to pay, because then skin has to be in the game, right? Otherwise, they will keep on elongating. They would not have a right buy-in. They would not put enough effort. So proactively asking them for that money, maybe there is a resistance, and you say, okay, once you convert it to final contract, this get adjusted. So I think that's another one which companies have to build a process around it and be very, very upfront on it.
And the traditional, profile of the salesperson that sells to these enterprises, the founders imagine, is going to be a charismatic person, people pleasing, and it's actually not.
Yeah.
Can you elaborate more on?
We both are very introvert, actually. I think before starting this, we hardly went to any stage, and maybe I would like him to go, he would like me to go. Right? But then there's no choice. Sometimes you have to do it, right? So we learned over a period of time, actually, and be natural, right? Because when you have a good product, when you have a good traction, I think that speaks for itself. So I think as a founder, keep hustling, get that first 10, 15 customers. When you get the first 10, 15 customers, understand their outcomes and ROI, just go and talk about that. That's what everybody wants. No need to glamour out of it or be flashy. I think just being natural works, actually. I don't think so there's anything extraordinary out of it.
But the people that you hired for your senior sales role, right? What kind of profiles or what kind of characteristics was common among them?
Yeah, so very early days when we hired, obviously we hired more founders or hustlers because none of us knew the playbook. We didn't know about sequence of events. We didn't know how to handle pilot. Nothing we knew. So we needed people who could figure it out, because as I talked about, every company product is different. So we looked a lot for people who can hustle. So it was either founders or it was these people, the people that we are hiring, do they show that hustling mentality? So that's what we have hired.
So they're mostly hands-on guys, actually, right? The guys who can act. Early on, it was like somebody who can roll up the sleeves and actually go give the demo. Somebody who can actually even work with the customers to do a pilot. It's not like somebody says, okay, I'm a senior guy, I need one sales engineer, I will need one POC guy, No, they should be able to run it. I'm talking about the first 4 or 5 people, actually, right? So being hands-on, being confident to run the show, I think that was very important. And we build the organization bottom-up. We never build top-down. So first 3-4 sales guys were actually A's. It was not like we hired a VP sales and we went down. Maybe it was correct in hindsight, because if we would have gone top down, our initial motion was SMB.
Yeah.
I would have hired maybe somebody who has done a lot of transactional sales at volumes, closing $1,000-$2,000 deal. Maybe 2 years down the line, maybe that was not a valid motion for us. I would have gone to enterprise. What would have happened to the VP sales? His whole team and the DNA would be accordingly.
Mm.
So in hindsight, like getting those A's, working with them, iterating with them and building that process, I think worked for us. And then once the playbook was established, then getting a senior person to actually scale it up. So again, I have to summarize in one line. I would say for initial, when your playbook is not defined, you don't know what's working, what's not working, no need to have a clear boundaries and constraints. Get hustlers who will actually define that playbook. once that playbook is defined, many of those hustlers will not be able to scale it because they need 0-to-1 problem. Get a scaler. Get somebody who has been there, done that for the similar kind of playbook. Let them come in and build it, scale it.
Another important thing is the titles part that you mentioned, right? Would love to dive deep into it. The kind of titles that you should give to your senior guys and how to deal with people's expectations regarding titles.
Maybe we can talk more about titleless. I can talk about the other philosophy. We were always stingy and frugal in terms of giving titles to individuals. When early on, when people came to me and I want to be X head, Y head, YVP, XVP of a particular department, I used to tell them, your company itself is $500,000 ARR. Calling you a head of XYZ doesn't resonate, right? Let's start at, let's say, director or something. And most of these guys were also coming from that director kind of a level or something. And they're not seen that much scale, or they're coming from large organization, but they have not built something from scratch. So giving that title in the middle management or something and making them grow that organization and also they can grow along with that organization really helped. Now, when we were, let's say, 1 million ARR, and if I want to hire somebody in sales or marketing or a product, I'm going to not attract a CPO or a CSO or someone who has been there, who has built from 1 million to 100 million. Why would they come to a $1 million organization? It's very hard to attract. So you would attract somebody who is like 7-year, 10-year experience, and you might, there's a high potential probability that you might over-designate them. And as an organization, you would grow much faster than any individual. And when organization goes beyond an individual, then you will have to get somebody else for that senior position, but then you already hired someone with that title. Now there's a collateral damage there, right? That person has to go, you can't demote. But that person would have been really terrific director for you, but then you lost it. So I would say never over-designate people at early stage. Give them the title, what is actually relevant for your organization at that point, and then let them grow over a period of time. Unless you're very, very sure that this motion is for my company, I'm very sure about it, that this is going to not only scale from 0-1, but even from 1-10 and 10-100. If you have a solid somebody in network, then it's fine.
Yeah. So the other thing which we've been working on for the last roughly 1.5-2 years is from an organization standpoint, moving to a descriptive title company. So generally companies are titled by directors, VP. So this is more seniority based titles. So those are not even telling exactly what this person is doing in that company. So the idea is to move to more descriptive titles in the company. For example, if someone is managing sales for enterprise in North America, then let the title say so, like head of sales for North America enterprise. So that's what we're moving towards. So the idea is that let employees fight for a better role where they can do, where they can increase their scope.
Rather than fighting for better titles.
Yeah, rather than fighting for a better
the role
title.
Is not clear.
They will aspire to take more ownership. Now it's like, okay, 2 years, give me next title.
Yeah. Probably somebody leading sales for Southeast Asia would aspire for leading sales for North America.
Correct.
Or maybe from Southeast Asia, can I do APAC?
Yeah.
Or APJ. So go for it, right? So rather than just saying, okay, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, like give me something next.
So same thing we are trying to apply across organization, right? From engineering to go-to-market functions to everywhere. Make it very descriptive. Well, the bottom line is that make people aspire for more scope and
another example if I want to add in this hiring part, since we have again, it's very close to my heart, and even Vara, we always talk on that. As I was mentioning very early on, identify what you're trying to solve and then try to solve that particular problem rather than solving a designation. So when somebody says, okay, go and hire a chief marketing officer, now why you need chief marketing officer? So this was a question a couple of years back for us. Maybe when we are $25 million ARR, are we even going to be attracting chief marketing officer, right? Or the chief marketing officer is typically a lot more branding guy, less more demand gen or tactical, right? Why we need, what we are trying to solve. So when we really started going deeper into this, we realized that demand gen is fine for us. The problem for us is how do we articulate our story? So it's more of product marketing problem, positioning, launching our products, creating thought leadership in content, analyst, scaling our analyst part. So we needed somebody who to head and refine our product marketing rather than overall chief marketing officer. Even if, let's say if I would have hired a chief marketing officer, he or she, what she would, they would have done. They would say, okay, demand gen is working. Let me scale this quickly to show results. Or to solve this product marketing problem, I need to hire now 2 more directors or a VP or something. It would delay my product marketing problem by 6 to 9 months. And maybe the person is poking too much in the demand gen, which is working fine for me. So we optimize saying, okay, let's get product marketing leader instead of a CMO for now. Maybe a little overhead for us, more reporting, But my problem gets solved immediately. Okay. And that was applicable across most of the departments. Again, that's another thing which worked for us.
So let's say the framework, like what am I trying to solve here for?
Yeah.
How did you apply it to your culture?
So initial days, we didn't have any culture principles written or anything. So what we learned over a period of time is that the way company is behaving is the way that we were behaving.
Yeah.
So the way that we were treating our customers, the way we were treating our employees, that's how the employees are treating others. So what we realized that the way we are, that has become the culture of the company. So then we sat and we wrote down our cultural principles. So given those are our, so much default in the way that we operate, so that continued to exist in the company and continue to spread. So whether it is our customer first, so that from the day one, it is that focus. And even today, the customer feedbacks and everything relate to the same thing. So every cultural principle, actually, we live by it. So it isn't just written in a document. It is just the way that we live every day.
I'll give a couple of examples here, actually. Right. So we didn't survey inside the organization, even before defining. That was like once we were 150 people or something. Like, what do you resonate core values when you think about WhatFix where you're working for some time, right? So people started coming up with different words, right? There were words which we wanted to have. There's a couple of words which we didn't want it to have. So that was unconsciously, we were having some cultural traits which we didn't want to promote, right? And some which we wanted to promote, like everybody started resonating, saying, okay, I'm able to build the trust with the company because you guys are transparent. So we continue till date, like in all hands, we share everything, right? Good or bad. And people resonate saying, okay, I can believe what these founders are saying. I can trust it. People started coming to us saying that, okay, I'm buying this software because it's cheap. Because one of the cultural traits we wanted to mention was like, let's be frugal.
Yeah.
Because we wanted to not be overspent. But that was not a cultural trait in terms of buying cheap. Doesn't mean like I don't buy inferior softwares or anything. So we consciously started refining frugal, but not cheap. Right? Go for the best in class. So we started defining those things that we want to change this. Some we wanted to change. Go for a best in class. Not cheap. Some places like transparency, hustle mode, hands-on, which came out as a positive, we actually doubled down on that.
Okay. And what are the mistakes that you made, let's say, on hiring, on culture, between 2016 to 2020?
Several mistakes, actually. See, half of my leadership today is people who have grown internally, right? My VP of products, or VP of demand gen, or VP of sales, they've all been here for 7-8 years, and they've grown along. Some places where some of these guys couldn't scale or some people couldn't scale, we had to complement with the leadership from the market, right? So we got several, half of the 50% is almost like we recruited laterally. Now, some of this hiring doesn't work. So internally, when it doesn't work to scale, I can always get someone because I've not over-designated that person. So that problem is kind of solved. But when you get something laterally, as I was mentioning, one is very clear that what we are getting this guy for. And we're solving this product marketing problem, I'm going to solve this problem or that problem, right? One or two experiences we had, we got someone to solve a specific problem, but that person was too early, too aggressive to career path. I want to dominate, I want to become X, CXO, B, CXO. They started encroaching upon other territories.
Yeah.
Right. So that was not a cultural territory. We always believed as one of our core values to specialize and go deep.
Yeah.
Right. So instead of person going deep, started going horizontal, troubling a lot of other things which are working fine. We had to part ways with a couple of people like that. So this is one of the mistakes I remember we did. Another mistake, maybe not that person's problem, might be our problem as well. Like, we assumed some kind of a motion that, okay, this kind of motion of sales will work, or this kind of motion in our demand generation or product would work. And we hire someone assuming that, but in 6 to 12 months, we realize, no, this is not the right motion. That person's skill set doesn't match how the company has evolved. We have to part ways.
And how do you figure out people who have been earlier part of your 0-1 journey, right? Super hustlers. And once you have achieved, let's say, for example, what took you from 0 to 10 mil ARR, now they are not able to learn the skill from 10 to 50 mil ARR. Do you part ways with them or do you give them other side projects?
So one, actually, first, we need to even give them enough ammunition or other ways to learn and perform, right? So giving that option. So many people actually don't want to grow also.
Okay.
They want to just solve 0-1.
Really?
Not. They want to keep solving new problems.
New problems.
There are a couple of people who have actually rotated horizontally in the organization. Yeah. Like, I have created a success business reviews playbook very, very clearly, thoroughly. Then go and solve my account management playbook and go and solve my some other playbook. So there are guys who are like 7 years rotated in 3 different positions, right? And they've been directors, senior directors and all. Then there are some guys who aspire, but they don't have enough exposure. So we push a lot. Not only for us, for our CXOs, for VPs, even to directors, get advisors, get coach. So somebody who has been there, done that before, right? I can, if I'm a VP sales, get a couple of SVPs or CROs from large companies, let's say AppDynamics or Okta, and spend like a couple of hours every month. Yeah. And company would pay for that, right? Learn from them, brainstorm, because sometimes you know the answer, you just need validation.
Somebody has to tell you.
So you brainstorm with them, and then you get that thing, okay, perfect, man, I was thinking right, then I'll go and aggressively implement. Or those guys actually identify and show you the blind spots. Hey man, like 12 months down the line, you're going to scale your team from 10 people to 40 people. You don't even have next layer. You start building next layer now, right? So somebody has to show you those path. And these are some of minor problems which can be solved. So having that advisors, regularly having that brainstorm with them, or if somebody's not able to scale, move around, or even after coaching, somebody doesn't not able to scale, have a clear talk with them. That, okay, let's get a leader who is 3x better than you. Like if I have a XYZ or let's say Vara is there, if I say Vara, I'm going to get somebody next to you and it's just going to be Vara plus, there's no motivation.
Yeah.
But it has to be Vara plus, plus, plus. So get somebody, that person who is working also is excited, motivated. Okay, man, this is the guy I'm going to work. I'll give you an example, like one of our directors. I wanted to get somebody on top of it, of that person. Initially, the person was disappointed. We discussed with him and say, okay, you are part of the hiring committee. If you say no, we're not going to hire. Because we want you to grow. But we feel if we get someone, it'll be terrific for you. Very good for company to scale up very fast in that particular department. We did few interviews. One of the interviews, that person came out, my director came out, so glowing. If I work with this guy for 2 years, my trajectory will change. Because the guy whom we were hiring was like 20 years experience, yeah. Worked in large 3-4 companies, came up so much of terrific experience. But give that all these options, something will work out, right? So person to person, how you plan, I think it could differ.
So what I see is WhatFix is more of an internal company rather than in many of the companies that have come out of India, which are many external facing. So I believe you guys would have spent like the least amount of fundraise. That's what I can...
Least amount of time in fundraise. So in fact, if I have to validate that, Series C, Series D, I didn't have a deck.
Okay.
I never hired an investment banker. All those rounds happened in MOM. So in that way, you can say we have spent the least amount. But if I have to say in Series A, B, we have spent a lot of amount of time because category was new. People were even asking basic questions. Is somebody going to pay for this? Is it feature or a product? Right? There's no corresponding large company to measure this category. Or so there was too many hard questions. And some extent, actually, mistake ours, like, we also didn't know. My first time was like $180-$200 million. More interest in that, right? Today, we are talking about $20 billion. Because we didn't know all the use cases. So it just made harder early on. But as we saw the traction, it became easier and easier.
So you're saying when as founder, you start to solve problem in SaaS, right? You can ignore time initially.
For yourself? Because for VCs, maybe not.
But was it hard for you? Like you raised your pre-seed from GSF. Then Helion, did it take you effort to get to Helion or raise that round?
Actually, Helion round, it wasn't as effort intensive.
Yeah, it wasn't.
So I think we spoke with Ashish when we were in Bay Area. 2-3 calls and it happened very quickly.
That was 2014, right?
Yeah, 14.
And the GSF trip happened the
just
same
after,
when you met.
Yeah. Actually, Series A was easier. I think Series B was the hardest.
Yeah.
Because it was transition from that early stage to growth stage and we had to answer all those data questions.
Yeah. In the early days, I think more than TAM, what excited Helion, if I remember well, was the number of variety of use cases. Because among the first 10 customers we have, every customer is using WhatFix for a different use case. That's what excited them because they felt the TAM is actually really big because every use case is really, really different.
I think Paul Graham says in one of his essays, right? Don't worry too much of TAM. Solve one problem deep enough for that particular people who will become your champions. And there are always very large adjacent market which you can actually solve later on.
But it's very hard for founders, like because I have been there, I can tell you, right? Why? Because as a first-time founder, even it's second time, right? You go out in the market to fundraise and VC, by definition, sitting on notch higher pedestal above you. When VCs tell you time is not enough, then there's self-doubt creeping in the founder, right? Then
I do have, because I've invested in several companies, right? Some of the founders come in and say, and I tell them, narrow down, man, narrow down, just solve this problem. Is yeah, VC is taking me the other way around. I said, but this is going to help you. Don't worry too much. Solve that problem thoroughly. You'll make that repeatable engine, repeatable messaging, and becomes more predictable. You can always add use cases actually, but solving for one going deep is very, very important.
I feel as long as the company has a strategy on how do you grow, how do you expand across that initial segment that you're targeting, and if that story is clear enough, I think it is okay. Should be able to convince anyone.
Because as you said, right, when in 2018, when Wispy joined you, you didn't have the answer how the company would be half a billion dollars. You had it will be 100 million.
For sure.
And we don't know the path beyond it.
We'll figure it out. That's what we thought, right? So that's a true, right? Like say tomorrow, today, somebody we talk, they'll say, okay, what's your path to 10 billion? Of course, we have some story, but I can't say what's my path to 50 billion or 100 billion.
Yeah.
We'll evolve over a period of time. So you have to at some point bet on the founders that these guys can figure out as they start working with the market and overall market landscape also you need to bet.
Yeah. And the second part is, right, you raise your round with Helion. I think Stellaris would have happened easily because all was already a newest stakeholder from the Helion side.
Yes. So that happened because I think we got a good product market fit by 2016 mid. The Dreamforce and other stuff, a lot of data points were there. I think that Alok also realized. By then, actually, Alok was not on the board. He was out. But we liked Alok's contribution so much that we used to talk to him every 6 to 8 weeks. Sure. And we said, would you be part of as an advisory board and all? Sure. But he said, no. He had already Kerry and all those things. He doesn't need to be. He can still talk to us. And by the time we got that strong product market fit and go to market fit, Alok said, I think I'm ready. You guys are ready for the next round. It was like almost like he preempted. We would have gone to market, we would have got more, but it just happened because we knew the value of what Alok brings because his prior life, like he was like in the sales for in SAP, and he had too much of contribution. He could have done, he did too much of contribution numbers, GTM and enterprise motions and all. And it was natural fit for us.
And if you both have to summarize, right? Like founders usually get stuck in one path that works for them. How you guys change path at what milestone, right? Or the way that you work, the way your GTM change. Because the best thing is finding something that works. The worst thing is just doing that only.
Once we got that product market fit and all, I think we did very religiously. I also tell a lot of founders, don't make plans for VCs. Make plans for yourself, right? So we did our annual planning and half year planning very religiously, even early on in 2017-18 also. Yeah. And every time when we do the annual planning or a business planning, we used to ask the question, what's big thing we are going to do this year, right? And that too in most of the functions, like, okay, if it's in sales, if you're going to do farming, if in success, what's different? And when you start debating, when you start going deeper, you get a lot of answers, what you want to experiment or what you want to try differently. And the same thing on the company level also, like, okay, we are doing fine with enterprise. Now what we do next? Okay, have a slice this year on verticalization. Maybe next year have a slice on adding more products and go more. So when you keep debating, when you religiously or sincerely do this planning, I think you get very good answers. And every time, as your company also scales, there are more good leaders on the board. They will also have a lot of ideas. So I think doing that with sincerity and with first principle approach, I think you will get good answers.
Yeah, no, nothing else to add. I mean, don't plan for VCs and plan for your own.
Another thing which I want to highlight is you very religiously followed, right, account plan reviews from very early on with the stakeholders. Yes. Let's dive deep into it.
Yeah, so as I was mentioning that new category, somebody buys you, they don't know, like sales would have oversold.
Yeah.
Just buy this, you'll get an ROI, right? Yeah. But then somebody has to really spend time with the customer, understanding their business use case right from there. What the problem they want to solve? How WhatFix can actually help solve that problem?
Yes.
How we can translate that into requirements and get WhatFix implemented? And then quarterly basis, we track, show them the ROI in the business reviews and see what more we can iterate every 2 quarters in solving more problems. Now, this sounds simple, but this gradually evolved and became a process for us. In each stage, we started having checks and balances. Like, okay, start with a business case template. Right? I think Vara was instrumental to build that. Like, we need to really have a strong business ROI, whether it's an operating metrics we are influencing, whether it's a revenue metric, risk or compliance. It has to be one of these 4 which we are impacting, not just very abstract productivity, right? Something has to be there. And then how do we measure it? So what kind of hooks we need in our system to measure those ROI parameters? How do we communicate? Who should be participating in the communication? Like there has to be a decision maker, there has to be a business owner there. And what should be my business review template? So we gradually build that template for, and then we started customizing template for different industries. And this is the my customer success and review process. And parallelly, another process started evolving after a few years. Like, okay, this is our account. Currently, this is my footprint in the account. What is this company does? What are the similar companies we have solved the problems for? What are the different departments we have actually solved? In this company, what is the budget? Who are the decision makers? What is the organization map? This became my farming account plan. And then success guys and account managers started working closely to map these accounts, to create those champions, reuse in different departments, get referral, and it evolved in a good way.
My last question is, right, one great method that you implemented is that one of the co-founders or senior leaders was responsible for 3 accounts or 4 accounts
yes.
in the company, right? And they would go with account managers to meet the leadership. on that account?
Yeah, we continue to do so now also. We call it as an internal sponsorship. So every leader has a set accounts. So the whole idea is twofold. One to help customer to make sure that there are no blockages for the customer, and we unblock and we do whatever we could to make the customer successful. And the second other big reason why we did that, it also gave the executive a direct visibility to that customer, understand that customer really well. So that helped both ways. It helped customers to be successful. It helped executives to be more closer to the ground.
No, thank you so much. You know, I can go on and on on the various nuances that you have built uniquely at WhatFix and what other founders can learn from you. Thank you so much, Khadim and Vara. It's been such a pleasure hosting you on the podcast.
Thank you, sir.
Pleasure to be here, and hope it helps some of your audiences.